So the story I'm going to tell today has its roots in various things. It's about interactions, and the interactions that we're talking about here have, first of all, to do with the classical and the venerable example of the Newtonian n-body problem. And later come other kinds of interactions, and I want to tell you what they are. And so what's the story that distinguishes these different kinds of interactions? So the first thing is that in the Newtonian setting, we all know very well that the forces of interaction are specified by potentials, specified explicitly ahead of time, and depending on whether you're doing chemistry or you're doing solar physics or other kinds of problems, you may choose to work with different kinds of potentials. In contrast, and hence different kinds of forces, in contrast, in the so-called Eulerian setting, by that I mean you're thinking about a lot of different bodies, which are rigid bodies, and they're hooked up with joints of various kinds, ball and socket or pin joints. And here, you don't really ever explicitly state what the forces of constraint are, the constrained reaction forces. Instead, you end up stating the constraint as a holonomic constraint, and then appropriately solve the problems, except when you have to do phenomenological things like you want to model friction in the joints, for instance, and then you have to specify them. And the roots of this are later than the Newtonian story, and perhaps should be traced back to the Adams Price essay, volume, treatise on systems of rigid bodies by Routh. And now in the more modern era come other kinds of many-body problems involving various kinds of interactions where you're not told about the interactions in any one way at all. Instead, you're told to synthesize them. And to what purpose? Well, you could think about these as particles moving around in three dimension or m dimension, or you could think of them as particles moving around in a group, a Lie group, and you are asked to synthesize the forces of interaction to achieve prescribed shapes, for instance, of these collections of particles. So this one would refer to this as formations if you're referring to engineering literature in this context, or flux in the context of biology. And so you're speaking about what interactions should be there in order to explain, for instance, in biological settings, various tendencies to flock together. So this is mainly the subject of my talk today. And before I get to that, I've started using the phrase shape, and so I want to spend a little time talking about shape, even though it has come up in other talks. So what is shape? Then I want to tell a little story about shape space, but from two different perspectives. Apparently, there has been a significant amount of interest in the statistical literature on what shape means, and there is a whole theory of shape space and related calculations that people have done, and I would like to tell a story and its linkages with the notions of shape space that we routinely use now in mechanics. Then I want to speak about control, in particular control of shape directly, as well as of shape indirectly via control of for one mechanism, it's going to be a control of individual curvatures for individual trajectories of elements in a formation. And this is going to be done via a mechanism of feedback from shape sensing. So exact modes of shape sensing are going to be left for another time, but it is possible to sense shape in various ways. So statisticians, for instance, ask, given a bunch of data points, either on a line or a plane or an RM, how can you describe the shape of the data? How can you distinguish between two shapes? How can you determine the distance between two shapes? In this setting, the data is given to you in a very static way, and you're not talking about any dynamics. You're not attaching any particular mechanical quantities to the points of data. So if that's the case, then the first idea, of course, is that shapes, if you want to talk about shapes, shapes should belong in some shape space, and one needs to coordinatize shape space. And we need to understand the shape of shape space itself, its topology and geometry. So in the statistical literature, there has been a tremendous influence of the work of the Cambridge statistician D.G. Kendall. And there are the so-called Kendall coordinates, which is an important idea dating back to these short note in the Advances in Applied Probability and later grew into extensive literature. And apparently, for Kendall, the interest grew out of studies of various problems in statistical archaeology and also in other domains. And there have been other contributors to this field, including Fred Buchstein from Michigan. And roughly, if you think about 3 points in the plane, you want to think about a triangle, then what is the shape of the triangle? Well, if you care about only shape and not size, then you're talking about triangles that are congruent. So you should expect there should be two angles that play a role in describing the space of all such triangular things. So the question really is, how does Kendall go about doing this? And so here's a very quick survey of that. Given k points in Rm, you collect them as vectors into x1 star through xk star and put them in a matrix, capital X star. You assign to this matrix, one, the centroid, suitably scaled, and then you also assign these additional vectors that are built out of differences between the data sets and the other centroids. And these x0 through xk minus 1 tilde is collected together in a matrix as shown here, and it's easy to see that this matrix is simply a right rotated version of the original data matrix, and this is a rotation element for rotation group element for 6 data points. This is an example. So the idea in this literature is that what you would do is you essentially, by going to the tilde variables, you have centered the data, and then by dropping the fifth column, you ignored the location of the center, and then you have this new matrix, capital X, which consists of only the elements of the original X tilde matrix, but then you have divided by size. This is important. They do this all the time. And what is size going to be, and how is size going to make sense? Precisely when you hypothesize that you can never have all points sit on top of each other. So you have sort of you remove degeneracy of all points or all collision, then you have the claim then that this matrix X is a non-zero matrix. Think of this as components of a big vector in M times K minus one dimensional space, and then look at the equivalent corresponding sphere, and that is going to be what one would call the pre-shaped space. So, yes. M-dimensional space is where the points fall, k of them, and then you've gotten rid of the centroidal term, and then so you've got k minus one vectors, and then you assume this non-degeneracy, no collisions. And not yet. Right now all we're getting rid of is just all points sitting on top of each other. But then what we're going to do is now in this space of matrices viewed as now points in a sphere, which is the so-called pre-shaped sphere. Why is a point in a sphere? Because you're dividing the data by the size being denoted as the sum of squares of all the components of the matrix, okay? So if you did that, then you have a point in the pre-shaped sphere, and then now you can talk about when are two such points equivalent. They're equivalent up to shape if they are related by left multiplication by the rotation group element. Okay. All of them, not all of them. You can have some lie on top of each other. If they're all lying on top of each other, then this will be the zero matrix. That's all. Okay, so the shape space is just the space of equivalence classes of matrices under this left action. So the literature has some beautiful results, but you know, some of them I want to mention here, the basic results. You think about this quotient space associated with this equivalence relation as the shape space of non-degenerate configurations. By that I mean the ones where all points can sit on top of each other. That's disallowed. Other than that, you have other types of collisions allowed. Easy exercise to verify that if you have points falling on a line, k of them, then the shape space is actually a sphere of dimension k minus 2. If you have points falling in the plane, k of them, then it's easy to take the planar coordinates and associate to them complex numbers. And then if you did that, then the shape space is going to end up being a complex projective space of complex dimension k minus 2. And then there is a curvature parameter 4 in the specific case where at a 3 points, it's actually a two-sphere of radius 1/2. Okay. And then finally, other general dimensions and so forth, there is a theorem of Casson that is that gives us a certain insight into what happens. Beyond this, there is still lots and lots of open territory about the geometry and topology of shape space, although there is quite a bit known in the literature, computing various types of classes, homotopy classes and such. So, briefly on this space, what kind of structures can exist? Any structures on shape space you can construct by dropping structures from the pre-shape space. And one way to do that is to put various things on the matrices, X, Y. So you can talk about the distance between two matrices, X and Y. It's they take the Frobenius norm distance between two matrices and take the twice the arc sine of one half of the Frobenius norm distance. And this is nothing but just the great circle metric on the pre-shape space. So that's actually a Riemannian metric there. Now you can drop it to a metric on the equivalence classes of shape space, and this is easily verified in this way as so corresponding to the Hausdorff distance. Okay. So plenty of structure in this. And this is the way statisticians have thought about shape, and this is a very wonderful story, and you can put Brownian motion on shape space and do interesting things in this context. In contrast to this, mechanicians have had a view of shape space. One can at least trace this back to Smale's program, and I'm going to tell you very briefly a few things and touch upon some things that we make use of in our work. So this is all very familiar territory for people, and there are some marvelous references I have found over the years. And so we're thinking about setting of simple mechanical systems with symmetry, where we traditionally assume that you have a group G acting on configuration space, but traditionally assume that it acts freely. And this is not something that is true in the particle system setting. It fails precisely having to do with not removing collisions and such. Okay. So you have a potential, you have a group action, and you have this notion of locked inertia tensor associated with configurations, which is a map from the Lie algebra to the dual of the Lie algebra, defined in terms of the kinetic energy metric. And all of this structure has been very useful for doing many things, including understanding relative equilibria of mechanical systems in this setting, understanding their stability properties, understanding small oscillation properties with respect to specific relative equilibria, and there is this lovely normal forms and such. And so, briefly, reference for this, I would like to mention, I like this paper that Jerry and Alan Weinstein wrote recently, the history, theory, and applications of symplectic reductions, and the references there, and also the earlier papers of Tudor, Jerry, and Richard Montgomery, and then the new edition of Mechanics and Symmetry. These things contain much of the story that various collaborations have been centered around, among other things. So the usual notion of shape space here in this mechanical setting, the mechanical view, is that we have the shape space as the quotient of the configuration space with respect to the group G. And again, it has nice structures. You have a notion of splitting of the tangent space of the configuration space into the vertical and horizontal directions, so there's a connection on this bundle Q over Q mod G. And toy examples like the ball and socket problem, these things turn out to be very tractable. Here, Q, the configuration space, is sitting in the Cartesian product of two copies of the Euclidean group. Each one of these rigid body potatoes is able to move around in space and also rotate, but within the constraint that they are coupled by a 3-degree of freedom joint, and that they're in free space and no forces, so conservation laws hold in this setting. And in this setting, the group is going to be SO3. The appropriate, well, you can think of it, you need to think about this as Euclidean group. I should have written properly there. And then the Q is really the submanifold that corresponds to the constraint. And in the easy case of, so the shape space is SO3 here, okay. And then in the case of the pin-jointed planar manipulator type setting, the shape space is torus. Okay, so now I want to draw a correspondence between the Kendall story and the mechanical story. So for this, we need to think about not just general mechanical systems in the sense of Smale or others, but instead think about particles in R3. And so we labeled the particles. They're not exchangeable. The labels are not exchangeable. Now, in this setting, you can do some things like what Kendall did, and this has been done a long time ago, too. And the thing is that you can take the differences between the position vectors of the particles and the centroid, and these denoted as CFI. And the important thing is that if you did that, the kinetic energy quadratic form splits in the following way. And there is, however, so one could think of this CFI as really giving us a way to express the configuration in the center of mass reference. However, there is some awkwardness here because this linear constraint has to be satisfied. One would like to account for this constraint by making things more explicit. And this is where there is the classical work of Jacobi that appears. And so these are the so-called Jacobi coordinates. Now we have gone from k distance of radial vectors from the centroid to the particles to k minus 1 Jacobi vectors. And given by this particular set of formulas, there are also other concepts of Jacobi coordinates that are generated by additional symmetries associated with this problem. This is so-called the democracy group. A good reference for this is Robert Littlejohn and Reinsch's well-known paper in the Reviews of Modern Physics. And so main message I would like to leave you with is that the Kendall coordinates are nothing but the Jacobi coordinates for the specific case where all the MIs are equal and equal to 1. And so in some sense, when we think about statistical view of shapes, we're not really that far apart from the mechanical view. And in fact, just pulling out from the statistical literature the tables of shape manifolds and their properties is a very helpful thing to do, in my opinion. So this is one story I wanted to leave you with. Now, the next story is that, by the way, if one wanted to know what, one thing that we don't do when we do mechanical things is we don't divide anything by a notion of size, because we really want to distinguish two configurations of particles which are very far apart in their distribution, which is very close together in distribution, as really being distinct, even if they have the same shape in the sense of congruence. So, however, if you really insist on dividing by something that corresponds to size, a certain classical mechanical object that seems to be helpful is something that is known in the literature as the virial function. The virial function, which plays an important role in various things in classical mechanics, is actually very much aligned to the way I was dividing by size quantity. So you can divide by this. And it makes sense to do that in the particle setting. So for our purposes, going back to my motivating picture of three types of interactions, the Newtonian and the Eulerian synthetic problems, I started at 11:15, right? So I'm doing okay? All right, thanks. Okay. All right, I don't want to rush too much. So the issue then is really how should one think about control problems associated with particles and spread out in space, where our task is to control the shape of the assembly of particles in some way. And we may choose to do it in more than one way. One way may be to have direct ability to control the shapes of these particles. And this is somewhat akin to imagining the falling cat problem, where the falling cat actually controls directly the relative displacements of the body component so that it actually achieves a certain specific shape in that sense. However, one may also want to think about other means of control which are more indirect, and I want to touch on both these things. Now, some of the machinery that is very useful in doing this has to do with constructions that are well known to physicists. Again, a good reference for this is the reference to Littlejohn and Reinsch that I gave earlier, and that is trying to express the mechanics of this many-particle system in coordinates that are compatible with the shape coordinates and also certain choices you might make. So what choices you're talking about? So there is a choice of what's called gauge convention. So what we mean by this is you pick a reference orientation for each shape. So you think about you are now in the K particle or N particle setting in R3 very concretely. And so you think about this collection of particles as having some shape, and this shape you can place in space in any way you like. So you have a reference orientation. The orientation, this is an orientation in which body frame and fixed frame, say the laboratory frame, coincide. Given a reference orientation and some actual orientation of the same shape, there is a group element that will carry you from the reference to the actual orientation. This comes from the fact that different placements are related by the rotation group, as in the very definition of what we mean by shapes as equivalence classes, right? So now this tells us a way to associate. So the CF alphas are the ones that we call the centroidal vectors, with namely the vectors going from the centroid of the system of particles to the individual particles. And then the rho F alpha are the Jacobi vectors. Okay. Again, I want to remind people that the choice of Jacobi vectors that we showed is not the only one. There are alternative ones. That freedom comes from the democracy group. Now, now one can associate to this representation various mechanical quantities, and these are very familiar. And these are all instances of things that come out in the general simple mechanical systems with symmetry picture that we all know. And so I've just written these basic differential equations associated with the kinematics of the Jacobi coordinates, the kinematics of the group variable, and also the notion of angular momentum and locked inertia tensor expressed in both the body version of the Jacobi vectors and the spatial version. So having done this with a certain amount of effort, one can actually express the Lagrangian entirely in the Q dot S dot G omega variables. This is all very standard by now. And one could also do this in a much more intrinsic way using the language of block diagonal normal forms and such. The point is that there is a way to describe things in which the shape variables and the shape velocities appear very explicitly. Okay, that's one of the reasons for doing this. And so S and S dot are the position, shape and shape velocities. That's right. That's right. So this is, I guess, going to be appearing again in Robert's talk later, having to do with chemistry and molecules that vibrate and rotate. So, okay. So this is a starting point for doing controls, but what I would do is look at the corresponding Lagrange-Delambé equation, put in forces, but now expressed in shape variables, U, G, U, S, etc., and then develop feedback laws. And then, having done that, one can ask, what are the feedback laws good for? You may want to stabilize a certain shape, a prescribed shape, or you may want to do some other things like change the shape into some other shape by a succession of changes. And here I want to emphasize that you ultimately want to hand back the authority to the particles themselves, namely the forces acting on the particles are the ones that are supposed to realize these shape changes. It's not as if somebody gets in there and deliberately turns the shape around, as it might be postulated in the falling cat problem. Okay, so I want to tell more details about the story, but there's not enough time, so I'm going to. Yeah. So the inertias, the key inertias are the locked inertia tensor here, and then there is the mass, the total mass of this particle.
So then it goes to zero with this specialized
Jacobi. No, the Jacobi coordinates are already here, in fact, they are here through the. I had a few slides ago. Okay. I rushed through that a bit. So I talked about this gauge convention. So this corresponds to essentially picking a cross section from the bundle, which is sitting on top of shape space. And then, so you are expressing everything here in terms of S's, okay? So this is the body version of Jacobi coordinates, and then this is the spatial version of the Jacobi coordinates, okay? Sorry, this is the spatial version, okay? And so the Jacobi coordinates are derivable from your choice of section and your choice of S notion, okay? And so the S is the shape variable. So we're now already at the level of, we don't want to live at the level of pre-shaped space. We want to live at the level of shaped space, okay? So anyway, the point of, so at this stage we are ready to do certain things, but I wanted to emphasize that really this is not all about particles interacting in R3. I want to talk about particles interacting in groups. So what do we mean by particles in groups? So my story here also dates back to some experiences that I had, very pleasant experiences I had visiting with folks at Caltech. So from particles in R3 to particles in a Lie group, the kind of examples I have in mind is in SE2, SE3, etc. So many years ago, I visited Joel Burdick's lab, and Joel had built machines like this, these marvelous machines. This is a sketch of this. So these machines look like they have a bunch of axles, and they have wheels on them. They are movable on the floor. And between these axles, there are these piston cylinder arrangements. The red things are the cylinders, the green things are the pistons. And you have enough between them so that you have at least locally full 3 degrees of freedom between the axle, this axle and this axle, by using the piston cylinder combination. So you imagine that you can put computers and motors into these things so that you can make this piston cylinder arrangements move around so that these axles are displaced. So that's the notion of deliberately getting in there and changing the shape. Okay, now this thing is not in air, it's sitting on the ground, and these wheels have sufficient contact with the ground and friction so that, first of all, they roll without slipping, and the wheel here and the wheel here are independently rotating, so you don't have any base problems. And they roll without slipping, and and you can certainly not slide, so the key constraint is no sliding. So what you have in hand here is a bunch of rigid bodies, each one allocated a copy of the rigid motion group element, group element in the plane, and then these are interacting through this deliberate shape changes. However, they also are interacting with the environment they are placed in, namely that the environment imposes this no sliding constraint. So that constraint, together with the interaction, has some interesting effects. So I want to say what those effects are, and the first thing is that, Shooter, what time do I stop? Another 10 minutes? Huh? Oh, okay, good. So the abstract view of this Burdick machines is to think about L copies of group G, where the individual particles live, okay? So for us, in this example, G is SE2. So this is what I mean by particles in a group. Each of them obeys the standard kinematics in a group where CIs are the velocity vectors in the body frame, so they are they are elements of Lie algebra. And now I think about the shape of this assembly instantaneously as these new quantities, which are still group valued, defined by taking this analog of differences that we would do in the Cartesian world. Instead of that, we take these inverses, okay? So in terms of these shape variables, the shape equations are very simple. These are going to be just kinematic equations, okay? And now, the important next step is that so consider a case where you have, suppose all the constraints are, the group that we're talking about is some n-dimensional group, associated Lie algebra, Gothic G there. Then suppose that the constraint that is imposed on each of these particles is that it lives in such a way that its body velocities are forced to live in a subspace of exactly one dimension lower than the dimension of the group, but that subspace is not closed under bracketing. So this would mean that the constraints that each particle experiences is a non-holonomic constraint. So you have L non-holonomic constraints acting on the L particles, and they are living in this
multiple copies of the same group element. So here's the story, that if L equal to N, there are as many particles as the group dimension, and under this hypothesis, there is the structure of a bundle, clearly, namely that this assembly could be put anywhere in the laboratory floor. So there is a full Euclidean group invariance, special invariance. There is an analogous invariance under an arbitrary group G. So this group G acts on Q to produce the shape space, which is one copy of G less. Okay, so this bundle carries a connection. There is no parameters in this problem like masses or anything like that. This is a natural connection coming from the fact that there are enough constraints and you can associate to them a certain distribution. Now, when you have connections, you can talk about curvature, and you can talk about the following idea, that if I change shape deliberately using these pistons and cylinders and motors, then what would happen to this assembly? Well, in Burdick's lab, as soon as he released one end of it, these guys would want to wander around the lab floor like a snake. And what is going on here is that there is a progression or overall transport, as in Roger's talk, caused by these oscillatory motions in shape space, which you execute. So this is one of the origins of why we call this kind of a model a G-snake in the work with Tsakiris and I did. Now, for L equal to N equal to 3, for instance, you have a three-dimensional group relevant to the special Euclidean case. And suppose you have three of these little axles, okay? So that would be three particles. Then the story is completely kinematic, no problem. Okay, everything is completely determined by this kinematic description. However, as soon as you come down one, namely if you have only two axles and still in the same group, then it's no longer a pure kinematic story. In fact, it gets more complicated because by just saying what the shape changes are, you cannot tell which way the system would go, how it would move. What is it? So this happens in a very nice way. And why does it happen? This has to do with the fact that when you have fewer particles, then you also have fewer constraints. The problem is under constraint. And this kind of problem is what led us to do work on non-holonomic systems with symmetry to discover additional, in one way of interpreting it, additional constraint. And the constraint comes from what is known as the non-holonomic momentum equation. And this is work that Bloch, Marsden, Murray, and I did. There is also the use of this notion in the setting of this example of the roller racer at some length, studying the dynamics and control of it, and the use of these ideas and another example known as the famous example on snake board, and Andrew Lewis is in the audience, who when he was a graduate student, he did things like this. So so this is a lot of fun to work on, to understand the interactions, then understand the limits of kinematic descriptions, and then from that, recognize the important role played by the right level of dynamical information that you bring to the picture, which certainly involves knowing a specific Lagrangian to the problem, which I haven't said what it is so far when I talk about G-snakes. It certainly involves the notion of possibly some external forces that are applied. And so all of that is important. But in this previous story, the interaction with the environment was important. That's what the constraint was. Additionally, you had full control over shape space. These are the two ingredients that we respected before. In what follows, which I have how many minutes for? Another 10 minutes or so? I have only indirect control over shape. So this is a new work. So this is what I want to talk a little bit about. So the idea here is that we're still back in the same world of interacting particles in a group. So the basic equations that I will write down will look very much the same as before. Just for convenience, I choose to write the shapes all reference to the first particle instead of between the particles. It doesn't matter because I don't really directly control the shapes anyway. I have choice here. So this is the shape that is associated with the reference with the configuration in G in the Cartesian product of groups. Okay, so the first observation is that we are going to demand those individual body velocity functions, which are elements of the algebra as functions of time, they have to be now described by a suitable feedback law. We don't know which one it is, but this feedback law is allowed to be only a function of g of f, i.e. a function of the shape alone. It cannot be dependent on the
spatial information, this information at the full configuration level. Then in that case, the dynamics I wrote down for the system of n particles projects to a dynamics on the shape space, which is of this form. This is a very trivial calculation. And for this dynamics, there is a notion of equilibrium shape, and the equilibrium conditions are this. Okay, it's very, very elementary to see that. Okay, so now one can ask, so the point I want to emphasize is I'm not controlling the shapes directly. I'm going to control them by these feedback laws that appear in the individual controls of the individual particles. Okay, those are the, now, so for this, and they have to be shape of, dependent on some sensing of the shape. So remind you, I want to remind you of some example here. Classic example is that of the description of a plane curve in terms of Frenet's array frames. So I'm writing down the standard equations, the R is the position on a curve at any point on the curve, and I'm thinking of this as a unit speed curve. So you should think of this T as arc length parameterization, or as time corresponding to unit speed motion. So then it's clear that you have the curvature entering into the picture, and this is the Frenet's array frame evolving in SE2. Okay. So U is equal to curvature. Now, if you just think this is just all kinematics, I want to remind you that equivalently, this description also corresponds to the motion of a particle in the plane of unit mass and units charge moving under an applied magnetic field, which is normal to the plane. And as long as the field magnitude is the same as the curvature, you get the same effect. Okay. Now, what do you mean by interaction? Well, I'm talking about interaction of two such Frenet's array frames. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to make the curvatures of the U1 and U2 scalar parameters to be dependent on the shape. Okay. So the shape in the setting would correspond to taking the Frenet's array frame G1 corresponding to one particle and taking its inverse and multiplying it with G2. That's the shape. Okay, there's only one shape coordinate, if you like. Now, two particles, but now the particle positions are lifted up to particles to the frame. So now so there are two frames. Okay, Euclidean group element associated with. Yes. So G1 inverse G2. So that's right, and also the displacements as vectors. Yeah, so the vector going from one particle to the other. So you keep track of that. So in fact, the shape space in this case is just a copy of the Euclidean group if you allow collisions. If you don't allow collisions, you get something that in which you have removed a point. It's in fact going to look like the a punctured plane cross S1 or T2 cross R. Okay, so and you do want to remove collision. Okay. So why do we care about this problem? Here's an example. Well, people want to fly planes out there, which are not just one, not too many. We want to control them. We want to be able to control them in such a way that form coherent groups or formations or flocks, just like we want to see what we see in biology. And so for that, we need appropriate feedback laws that sense what's going on with regard to one element of this collection, are viewed from the point of perspective of another element, okay? And so the discovery of equilibrium shapes and feedback laws is important. And so I want to just tell you that the equilibrium shape equation that I wrote down specialized in this case to the following very elementary equations, namely that if the control value at the particular equilibrium of interest to you is actually zero, then the elements G11, etc., these are the elements, components of the Euclidean group element of shape, are defined in this way. These are arbitrary. If it is non-zero, there is an easy way to calculate the control value at the shape from the shape variables themselves, which is what this is. And the denominator is non-zero because you have excluded collisions. Okay. Okay. So what are equilibrium shapes in this case? In this very simple case, it looks either like this, where two particles are going in the same direction, straight lines, one maybe ahead of the other, and so there is this vector going from one to the other, or they're both going at some constant
Well, first of all, I want to remind people, this is always the particles are always going at unit speed. The only thing you have control over is the curvature, okay, the steering, if you like. Okay, so here there's going to be a constant, not equal to zero, then you end up having both particles on the circle, on a common circle. And these do not have to be antipodal. So in fact, there is, depends on initial conditions and such. So these are possible equilibrium shapes. There's nothing else. Okay. I want to remind you that what we have done so far only fixes the boundary condition for a feedback law, namely the UE corresponds to the value of the control or feedback law evaluated at a particular shape. Then we still need to know what feedback law will actually drag you to this desired equilibrium shape. So there's some kind of asymptotic stability story to be told. So here's one that I want to write down entirely in terms of shape variables, and it's very natural, and it has got certain things that look like 1 over r squared type interaction terms. These things are at your disposal, fr, mu r are at your disposal. This notation, g super 2, 3, g 1, super 1, 3, corresponds to taking the corresponding components of the inverse of the shape matrix. So it's the usual convention in differential geometry. Okay, so that's all I'm doing here. So these are the two feedback laws for the two particles or two frames. Okay, so there is an associated Lyapunov function, and that Lyapunov function is also expressible in a clean enough way. And there is an interesting argument, and that I'm going to just sort of flash this hypothesis, that these mu and eta functions, they have to have basic inequalities. If they do, then using an argument that is very commonly used in the theory of asymptotic stability, namely LaSalle's invariance principle, one can show that the trajectory starting in an appropriate sub-level set of the Lyapunov function will converge to only equilibrium shapes, nothing else, okay? And so this idea of can be extended to n particles in SE2, although some details are still to be worked out, and I just want to close this talk with a few simulation graphs. So here's an example where you take a bunch of particles randomly distributed in R2, and then you apply these appropriate n-dimensional generalizations of n-particle generalization of the feedback laws that I wrote down for you for the two-particle case. And then what is happening here is that they are, you know, going every which way, and then they start getting aligned, and then after a while, they remain as a stable, coherent group. They're always going at unit speed. I want to remind you of that. Here, they start here, and they do some bending, and then go off. Now, what you're doing is you're initializing this collection of particles to go in a specific direction, go to have a certain equilibrium shape. No, so the description that I am making, no, see, you're always flying at unit speed. So you're not, and you're allowed to change. Your curvature is your control, right? Yeah, you're controlling. No. It's not just the potentials. I mean, the interaction is at the level of curvature. It's not at the level of position. So it's not, so that's the basic difference.
So the whole system doesn't conserve totally momentum.
If you want to think of it as particle. With mass and a magnetic field of some kind, it's not conserving linear momentum. No. Yeah.
Are you saying that n is somehow put into the initial condition?
No, it's something that it's a combination of initial conditions and the feedback loss. That I mean, so as you can see, it happens in some situations, it doesn't happen in other situations in any strong way. So all you manage to achieve at the end of the story here is that there is a certain grouping, certain prescribed shape that you get to. That's it. Okay? And now you can also alter such shapes, for instance, and say if you don't like this shape too close, you can modify some of the parameters in the feedback laws. So you can play a lot of games like this, and we also are doing other things like this. And I believe that there is a marvelous test bed that Richard Murray and collaborators at Caltech have built relatively recently, which may be useful way to explore these curvature control laws because you have these differential fans on your robots, right? Yeah. Okay, I want to close this talk, Jerry, to wish you a happy birthday and many thanks for your friendship, collaboration, and many years of teaching. Thank you.